World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. Angus Hughes survived a notorious prisoner of war march across the ice and snow of Germany in 1945. He'd jumped from his stricken Lancaster, been held in solitary confinement on his 21st birthday, taken to a prison camp, and then forced by his captors to head westwards on starvation rations ahead of the advancing Russian forces. Long before this, Angus had developed a resilient nature, nurtured by his World War I veteran father.
He joined the AIF. He was injured in France, and then he was transferred over to England, where he joined the Australian Flying Corps. He was over there for approximately 3 years. He married a girl from Stroud. Her name was Hilda Cove, and they came to Australia in the SS Berryman in 1919. He built a house at Croydon in South Australia, and I was born there on the 7th of October 1923. I went to a Croydon public school until grade 7. That's the old grade 7. And then I went to Queen's College, and after that I went to Bearden College for a business career. My first job at the age of 16 was at the ICI Alkali down at Osborne, where I was virtually a message boy. From there I... At the age of 18, on my birthday, I applied to the RAAF, joined the RAF. I was on the reserve until June 1942.
Let me take you back a bit. Was your father a very influential figure? Did he tell you much about the realities of war?
No, the only thing he said to me was he mentioned about a pilot, and somehow I got a feeling that he may have been injured in a plane, but that's only my guess. But he wasn't very keen on flying and on me flying.
I wondered about that because the casualty rate was so high, especially in the First World War. He didn't try to dissuade you from joining the Air Force then?
No. Once he signed on the dotted line, that was it. From October 41 till June 42, I studied navigation. They had special classes where we could go. It was in... Godger Street in town, and the old school there. Yeah. And that's how I became interested to be an observer, which was mainly navigation.
Yes. And so you'd had a really thorough grounding, and by the time you became full-time enlisted in the Air Force, you're well-trained, ready to go, you pretty well knew what you were doing. What happened next after your enlistment was formalised in July 1942? Were you taken off interstate for training? Where else did you go?
Oh, once we got the call up, there was several several of us were all sent down to Victor Harbour, which was the initial training school, and we had three months training, which was mainly exercise fitness. At the time, there was very little work as far as flying or navigation or was concerned. And from there, we were allocated our positions. Everyone wanted to be a pilot, but I was determined I wanted to be an observer. And fortunately, with the navigation that I'd already achieved, I was selected as an observer, along with several other of my friends.
Is there a difference, or perhaps you could explain it to me, between being a navigator and an observer?
Well, the navigator is a straight-out navigation, whereas the observer was a navigator. He did a course in bomb aiming, and also he did a course in air gunnery.
I understand.
You did 3 months ITS, 3 months navigation, 2 months bombing and gunnery, and 1 month astro navigation.
Thank you. That first term you used there, 3 months IGS, did you say? What was that? The first...
Yeah, 4 ITS, initial training school.
4 ITS is initial training school.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. And so after you'd done this specialised training, now it was time to be posted to a unit, to a squadron.
Yes, well, we were... From there, we all went over to Bradford in Sydney, and from there we caught a train to Brisbane. From Brisbane, we were on about a 6,000-ton freighter, which took approximately three weeks to get from Brisbane across to San Francisco.
Now, what an incredible experience to travel across the Pacific to America. What are your recollections of that voyage?
Well, I'm not sure if it was the first or second or third night, the Japanese sunk the Centaur, the hospital ship.
Yes.
And who they were, if they were after us also, I don't know, but fortunately they didn't come across us. From San Francisco we went by train to American camp at Taunton, Massachusetts. We were there for 6 weeks waiting for a ship, and eventually we were on the old Queen Elizabeth, and I think there was somewhere between 15 to 20,000 people, men on board, and which took 6 days to get to Greenock in Scotland.
In the meantime, though, had you sampled any American hospitality, either in San Francisco or Massachusetts or on the way across?
Oh, yes. We had several days leave. I had a week in New York, and I was billeted with a family in New York with a friend of mine, Kevin Juncture, who was an air gunner, or wireless air gunner. And we went out to the old Air Force base there with the Americans. And apart from us two sergeants, I think the lowest rank was a vice admiral.
So, what do you remember of American hospitality and generosity?
Oh, it was very good.
Yeah.
They couldn't do enough for us. They being Australians, they didn't know much about Australia, and they got told a lot of stories about Australia. And
tell me some of those, because I think I know what you're alluding to. What sort of stories did you spin when you were talking to them?
Well, they were always interested in kangaroos, and one of the stories was that all the wheels were like triangles, and as the kangaroo jumped, the cart behind could go along with him. Also, they had records. You could make a record run by Coca-Cola, and I sent one home to my mother, which I've still got here now.
Lovely. Yeah. Oh, that's lovely. But then there was a war to be won, and you sailed across the Atlantic in a convoy, I guess. Dangerous voyage.
No, there was no convoy. It was just the Queen Elizabeth by itself. It had a going out of the harbour. It had we had one or two destroyers.
Yes.
But at nightfall they disappeared, and the next thing we knew, we saw a Lancaster overhead heading into Scotland.
So there was a constant threat for attack by U-boat, but you didn't experience anything.
No. Apparently, Queen Elizabeth and the Queen Mary were too fast.
Yes.
For the U-boats.
You got to Greenock in Scotland. And what were your first impressions there?
Well, we got off the boat, and by train we went down to Brighton, the south coast.
Oh, yes.
We were there for quite a while. I don't know how the training, they were trying to get us there, but apparently they had it. Their training must have been complete. We were sent on a commando course for 6 weeks at Whitley Bay, and from there we went to West Shrew for bombing training, and from there we went to an OTU, Flying Wellingtons. After 3 weeks from there, we were transferred to a place called Swinderby, where we flew in Stirlings.
Yes.
That was the beginning of the four-engined planes. And after satisfying the likes-to-be, we were transferred then to the Lancaster. We spent a month at there, and then we were transferred over to 467 Squadron.
So
on the 6th of June.
So it's June 1944. After intensive training all over the country, from Scotland down to the south coast of England, up to Whitley Bay in the northeast. After more training, you get to 467 Squadron with your Lancasters. And you've got a permanent appointment now.
Permanent appointment.
And they were based, 467 Squadron was based at?
467 Squadron was based at Waddington. And that's just very close to Lincoln.
Thank you. Okay. Famous Squadron. And this was June 44. How long was it before you were off on operations?
Well, we were flying on the day we got there. We weren't flying operations. Our first operation was on the 12th of June.
Yes. I've got a photograph here of your crew, 7-man crew.
Yes.
You remember them all vividly?
Yes. six of us were Australians, and this chappie here, Taffy Barnes, he was Welsh.
Right. So, Australian pilot
from Western Australia. Yes. The navigator was from Victoria.
Yes.
Bluey, Alan Meigs, was from Victoria. And Bruce Bromelow was from Western Australia. And Polly Perkins was from Penrith in New South Wales.
Right.
Which now is part of Sydney, I believe.
Exactly. And there you are, member of a seven-man crew, very tightly knit crew. And you were observer, and you had another skill as well, I believe.
Well, I was a bomb aimer.
Bomb aimer.
I was a bomb aimer on the crew,
So your task was bomb aimer.
Yeah.
Highly complex, extraordinarily difficult and precise to get it right. Took a lot of concentration.
It meant a very close contact between the bomb aimer and the pilot. And fortunately, our pilot, Dusty, he had experience in flying before the war, so he was quite a good pilot. He's a much older.
I was going to say, the Air Force was renowned for its youth, but looking at Dusty, the pilot...
Yeah, he would have been... He'd have been 10 years older than me.
Yes.
And Mac here would have been eight years older than me.
Right.
Mac was also an instructor in South Australia, in Victoria.
So you were...
In navigation.
You were 20 by this stage, and these fellas are 30 years. So that was somewhat considerably older than the average crew. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you were on operations pretty smartly. What are your recollections of the first encounter with German ground defence? What was your first operation?
First operation was in Esch for Sugar.
Ah.
That's the plane, the Lancaster, that did 137 trips, and it's also in the museum at Hendon in London.
Extraordinary record. And where did you go on this up? Can you
that
recall?
One, we went down to a place called Poitiers in France.
Yes.
It was a marshalling yard for the Germans.
And you encountered with the flak. What are your recollections there?
Well, fortunately, at night you didn't see much flak. The main thing was the searchlights. To dodge the searchlights. On the daylight you saw the flak, but at night, of course, you didn't see them, but though it was still there.
I was talking to a Pathfinder pilot who said if you were caught in a searchlight, it was very hard to get out of it.
Yes, they had a blue beam, which apparently was radar controlled, and once you got on, if you got caught in that, other searchlights would converge on you, and of course it was easier for the AK-AK guns.
Yes. Now the general tour, I understood, was operations, say 30 operations, but you did slightly more than that. During this time, were you hit very often on this long record of active service?
Oh, well, we had several bad mainly flak. We got attacked by at Gelsenkirchen, and we got attacked by fighters, but fortunately we beat them. But on our, I think it was our 24th trip, we got badly hit with flak. We our hydraulics were damaged. We couldn't open, we didn't know if, regarding the bomb load. We still had the bomb load on board, which was about 13,000 pound of bombs with a 4,000 pound cookie in the middle. And they didn't know if we dropped the bombs, if the weight would have opened the doors, the bomb doors, or not. So we kept them on there, because if we had to open, if we had to drop the bombs and they would lie on the base of the bomb bay, they could have easily exploded, because the little propellers that worked off as the bombs went down would have all moved out.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there, just for the sake of anyone listening to this broadcast, and because it's a significant historical record, could you just explain the significance of the cookie in the bomb load?
Well, that was a 4,000 pound, just a high explosive bomb. It just looked like a 44 gallon drum.
Right. So that was op number 24.
I think it was number 24.
Yes.
But when we landed, one of our wheels had come down. It didn't lock.
Right.
And of course, we pranged on the runway. The aircraft was written off for several weeks.
Right. But you got out of that on
scale. We all got out. Okay.
Nasty moment there. But then things took a turn for the worst, and you had, you first of all, a reason to celebrate, because you turned 21 in early October 1944, but it wasn't the usual sort of celebration. Leading up to that, you'd had some news that never got to you. I understand that from being a flight sergeant, you were about to be made an officer, commissioned as an officer.
That's right, yes. It came through of September, and our last trip was on the 26th, and I didn't know about it. And of course, I didn't know about it until I got back.
Well,
back to England.
It's a long time between what happened then and when you got back, because on the 25th, it was the 25th of September you left on this particular operation?
26th
of September, 1944. And you were shot down.
We were shot down and on the way to Karlsruhe. We had an engine knocked out. It was on fire. And the pilot gave instructions to abandon the aircraft. Well, the six of us got out, and unfortunately, Polly Perkins somehow didn't quite make it.
You put your parachute on?
Yes, we had our parachutes on, and I think we were somewhere about, I'm not sure the height, but I think we would have been somewhere between 16 and 18,000 feet. Yes. At the time.
And you were shot down by fighters or by
by flak, actually.
Flak, yes.
Because the motor was on fire, it was virtually knocked out of the plane.
Okay.
And coming down, I must have hit my head against the panel coming out, and I don't remember that much, but I do remember seeing the plane crashed in the darkness. I could see the explosion just there, and when I landed, I didn't know where I was. And
had you jumped before?
I hadn't jumped before. First time lucky. And fortunately, I landed up next to a little creek. But you couldn't see a thing at night, and I still got a bad back from the way I landed on the ground.
Yes. But you did land.
I did land.
And you'd done, by this stage, 31, 32 operations, is that right?
That's right, yes. 30... That was that 30, actually it was a 33rd, but right. I always thought it was 32, but I found one I hadn't numbered.
We'll call you 32 and a half, if you like. So six of the crew survived.
Yeah, six of the crew survived, and two of them were in the same camp as I was in.
Good, thank you.
But they were there. I didn't get there until about 6 weeks afterwards. I eventually got down to the Rhine after two nights.
So you walked for two nights?
Yes, I walked for two nights. And
scavenging, what were you doing?
Well, there was a lot of old fruit around, and we always carried a pack of solid food, like very hard chocolate, and also a little water bag, and also foreign money. We carried foreign money.
Right.
But once I got down to the Rhine, and there was a lot of canals coming out there. I swam across a couple of them, and unfortunately, it was late at night, and I was wet through the next morning, and I was walking along the Rhine, and that's when I got caught.
Can you describe that for us? Who caught you, and what did they say to you?
Yeah, there was an old lady went past by me, and I just shook my head, and she could see that I was wet.
Yes.
And there was one of the equivalent of the Home Guard behind there, and he bailed me up.
Yes.
From there I went to a jail, and they didn't know what to do with me, and then I finished up in a German jail for a month. And then eventually I was transferred over to the interrogation camp and then we were loaded on trains and to our Stammlager 7B at Bankau.
Now, you'd been in a German jail then for your 21st birthday.
From a 21st birthday, yes. I don't know how many had their 21st birthday in a German jail.
In solitary?
In solitary, yes.
Ah, gracious me.
There was no Christmas cake.
And so, what about the interrogation? What was that like?
Well, apparently they knew who I was. Mm-hmm. The interrogator knew who I was, and also what squadron I'd come from. So, apparently they knew most of the squadrons in the RAF.
Mm-hmm. Were you threatened with execution if you didn't reveal information? How bad was it?
No, I wasn't actually threatened, but all the little pieces, I had a map and a watch and several other little things which they confiscated from me. But the only thing I did keep was my compass. We always had a compass as a button. They took my whistle away, which we always carried.
What? Angus, or Gus, as they called you in the Air Force, what were your sentiments, your mood? Were you frightened? Were you angry? Were you bored? What was it like during this period of being held in the jail and then the interrogation?
Oh, just bored. You never, you know, you just lived day by day. So you didn't know what was going to happen. You knew what the Jerries were like, and it was just a day by day living virtually.
Short of food?
Very short of food, yeah. And as the war went on, the food got less and less.
So it's late 44 now, and you've found your prison camp, your home, the Stammlager at... Begins with a B. What was the name of the place?
Bankau.
Bankau, yes.
Bankau.
Yes. Now that is... So we can locate that. Was that actually in Germany or just outside?
I think it's somewhere close on the border of Poland.
Yep. Okay.
Or Czechoslovakia, Poland. I think it was in Czechoslovakia.
It's quite a long way east.
Yes, east of Berlin.
All right. Now, you're in a prison camp, and you're a flight sergeant, and if it had been known that the promulgation of your promotion and your commission, that had been known, you might have had a better deal and gone to a better camp.
No, I most probably would have gone to the same campus where the pilot went.
Yes. So what were you subjected to in the prison camp? What was your daily life like there? Was it escaping on the agenda at all, or that was impossible by this time?
Well, escaping was almost impossible in the cold and the snow.
Yeah.
I only had the clothes I was shot down in, and somehow I did get a pair of boots. Where they came from, I don't know, because our flying boots, I cut the tops off. We had a special flying boot where you could cut the top off, and they just looked like my ordinary shoes.
Yes.
So I had those until I got these pair of boots.
So you're in Bankau, and winter has come on. It's a pretty savage time of year. Any Red Cross parcels, anything like that?
Oh, there was always the odd Red Cross parcel. All the tins were opened. I always had a nail hole in them, so they couldn't be used for escaping. When we got the Red Cross parcels, I think they'd mainly been pilfered.
Yes.
And then, depending on how many was in the room, they were divided equally.
And surely a problem would have been a fear of back home. Did your parents, your family were concerned? Were you able to notify and be assured that people knew you were still alive?
Apparently, through the Red Cross, they received a notification that I was in a POW camp.
So that gave you some sort of feeling of peace.
Yeah. But I didn't know that.
And what was your health like at this time on such short rations? In the dirt, and I guess there was a constant problem of delousing, that sort of thing.
Oh, yes. Yeah. There was a lot of... You were... spent a lot of time chasing lice around your clothes, your singlet, and in the real cold weather, two of us... Two would sleep on the one bunk for warmth.
Sure. Germans persecute you very much? Raids for radios and things like that?
Oh, well, you would be called out at all times of the night.
Yep.
In the camp was all wooden camps, and it was all above ground, and they used to have their dogs underneath.
Yes. And the dogs, sniffer dogs would come around all the time.
Yeah, they'd put them off every so often.
But there were occasional lighter moments. You put on concerts, I understand.
Yes, I had a few musical instruments there, and as a kid I learnt the saxophone, and they wanted someone to play the saxophone, so I with another Englishman, we had a little band, and we used that as a concert.
Yes.
For concerts.
So all up, you had some 3 months or so at Bankau prison camp.
Yes.
And a time of hunger and dirt and, again, tedium, I suppose, boredom.
They took us a couple of times down to a delousing place, but it was just a matter of putting all your clothes through this steamer or whatever they had there, and you just put them back on wet.
What did you do for Christmas 1944?
It was just another day.
Yes, okay. But then the Germans themselves had something to fear, because in January 45, the Soviet army burst across the Vistula River, 200 miles from Bankau, and they were advancing fast.
Yes, so they were. When we left Bankau, you could actually see the flashes in the distance of the approaching Russians. And that was the worst part of the whole trip, was the next 21 days.
Now, just take us through this, because the Germans wanted to move you all, wanted to get you away. What were your thoughts at this time? What did you discuss among yourselves, the prospects of being seized, being captured by the Russians instead of the Germans?
Yes, well, the Russians, we didn't know much about them, but we knew they were a fairly strong crowd, really, and we had no option but to go along with the German.
Yes.
Under armed guard.
Yes. Well, the next thing we're going to go to is the march, the incredible march right across Germany. So begins the long march to freedom. Remarkably, you were able to keep a diary of these days, and I've seen the original tiny sheets of paper, little writing, but it tells a very big and dramatic story. 18th of the 1st, 1945, to bed early, things prepared for a rush order of moving, an air raid, two bombs, less than 1,000 yards from the barracks. Germans told us to move at 05:20 hours on the 19th of January. We move off. Terrible cold, 5 degrees below, progress slow, roads slippery, don't know where we are going. Evacuees, trucks, carts, just a terrible mass evacuation. And you just had to keep marching. What were your feelings at this stage?
Well, we took as much as we could.
Yeah.
The road, I can still remember the road. It was just impossible walking on it. You could take a step and slip and... But once we got onto the snow, it was a little better.
Yes.
But the ice on the road was absolutely terrible. And of course, the other thing, the cold, being cold, well, we had no extra clothes or anything like that. We took the blankets we had at the at the camp, but of course I was so thin that though they were actually a little better than nothing.
Again, I'm looking at your diary and the entry for the 20th of January, and you're still marching. You're marching from the border in the east of Germany. You're marching right across in the direction of Berlin. Long way to go. There's firing in the distance. That's the advancing Russians. Frost forms on your faces and your eyelids, you say here. Did you just... were you tempted to just run for it?
Well, there was no point in running because it was just a mass of snow. Yeah. You had no food. What were you going to do if you ran? You'd only get shot. So you might as well be with the mob.
But you were...
altogether, we were comparatively safe.
Yes.
As you could be.
Yes, sure. But you were slowed down by the onset of frostbite?
Frostbite. And at night we would sleep with either in the cattle, in the sheds where either cattle or pigs or...
And you say here that the you received some rye biscuits, food has been practically nil, and chaps are falling out exhausted by the roadside. But yeah, somehow you kept going.
Yep, you just kept going. And
the field cookhouse overturns. Terrible irony.
Yeah, well, they had a burnt on wheels. It was like a 44-gallon drum, which was a on wheels, which added for cooking the so-called soup. But in the snow, like a lot of things, it just tipped over. A lot of people would fall over. I suppose, I can't remember if I did or not, but I should imagine that I did.
You say that by the 12th day, you'd arrived in a terrible state at a place called Petrovice, 200 men suffering from frostbite. You were able to exchange a gold ring for some goodies. What did you get for that?
Oh, not... that wasn't... I didn't exchange it, but some of the people that had these things did.
Yes. And the gold ring could buy extra food?
Yeah, it might buy the likes of a potato or something like that.
And marching on and on in this astonishing and historic march, 70,000 or more British prisoners of war, British Commonwealth prisoners of war on the roads in Germany. And it lasted 21 days until you reached a place, a camp, some 50 kilometres to the south of Berlin.
Yes. And we did catch... and we got loaded onto trains at Sagen.
Sagen, yes.
I think we got loaded onto trains there, and there was about 50 or 60 in the carriage.
Conditions appalling, though, on the train.
Mm-hmm.
The conditions would have been very bad on
the train. Oh, it was just... there was no seats. It was just like cattle trucks.
Well, the comparison to the life of cattle is an accurate one, because I understand that silage for the cattle had even been eaten by men.
Yeah.
So desperate were you.
That's right.
What was that like?
Well, we just had to eat something.
Yeah. Well, that is desperation, indeed. But you got to the prison camp. You survived. Well,
we did get to the prison camp alive. I'd lost a... I think I must have lost a couple of stone on the way.
Yes.
I don't know. That's the old...
Exactly.
The old weights.
Something kept you going.
Yep. It just had to keep going, and
So where did you get to at the end of this march? What was the name of the camp?
It was a place called Luckenbau.
Yes.
That's all. I don't know the exact pronunciation, but it was just south of Berlin. And while we were there, you could we could hear the every night the mosquitoes would be going over bombing Berlin. That was quite good, really.
Did you have any information by this stage? Did you have a radio somewhere, access to the BBC?
Yes, someone had a radio. There was a radio. We had a radio in the first camp. I didn't have it. I never saw the radio, but it was there.
So you'd reached the camp south of Berlin in early February 45. There was only 3 months of the war to go, although maybe you didn't know that at that stage.
We had no idea. No. In March, apparently Hitler had given orders that all prisoners of war were to be shot.
Mm.
And in March, we were marched out of this camp alongside big trenches. We were there for a minute or so, and then we were marched back again.
Yeah.
So it would appear that that the Allies must have been too close to the camp for them to do anything with us.
Mm-hmm.
We were eventually liberated by the Russians, and at that time the Yanks came along with their trucks to take us all back, and the Russians wouldn't let us go, so we're there for another month after the war finished,
with bargaining, arguing, trade-off to see what happened to you.
So we're just there in the camp for a month, just doing nothing.
Had the food and conditions improved by this stage?
Well, slightly, because it was mainly the Russian food. It was like the Russian army was there, but eventually the Americans came with their trucks, and they flew us to Leipzig, Halle, Leipzig, and from there we flew to Brussels.
Right.
And from Brussels we were given money for the night and I think we all finished up at a pub somewhere, and the next day we were flown back to England.
Your emotions must have been running so high. Incredible
things.
Relief
are,
and
things have changed a lot in a matter of 3 months.
Yes, because amongst your astonishing collection of mementos, you've even got a scorecard here, the cricket match between the touring Australian services team and England at Lord's.
Yes, that was after the that was in June or July, I think it was. July.
What a transformation.
Yeah.
Incredible. And were you able to go to the cricket or take part in any of these celebrations with your old comrades from the crew?
Oh, yes. We went to the cricket match there for the one day.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd spend a lot of time at Australia House,
yes.
which was where we could eat well, and also we had the advantage, if we wanted to go and work. Like, they couldn't ship us all home at once, so they gave us the option, if we worked with an English company, you could go and apply apply to get to work with them.
Yep.
So I was fortunate enough. I went to the ICI in London, and I was with them for 6 weeks. I went to Welland, Garden City,
yes,
where they had a factory, and also I went to Norwich, where they had a factory similar to the one down at Osborne.
And what sort of work were you doing there?
Just clerical work.
And your health was...
was getting better all the time.
Frostbite?
That all gone.
Yeah.
I was just... The only thing that happened, really, my stomach just went out.
Yeah.
And I still got that now. It's all... apparently it's split. There's something in there that's split.
But there was time for celebration as well.
Oh, yes.
Dances and girlfriends and...
No, I know. It didn't matter so much for the girls. It was mainly in the pubs.
Yeah. Now, what arrangements were made for getting you back to Australia then? How did they fix this?
Once we got back to... out of our assignments, we were given so much time to go and work for any company that you worked with prior to enlistment. We went back to Brighton, and then it was just a matter of allocation.
Yes.
And I finished up, I think it was in November, that we boarded the Strathaiden at Liverpool.
For a remarkable voyage back to Australia.
Yeah.
A colourful, memorable voyage. What sort of things did you see?
Well, we went through the Suez Canal.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Australians... they were wrapping up halfpennies and pennies, and it was silver and throwing into the Egyptians that were swimming round the boat.
Yeah.
Things like that. But the actual voyage back was quite good. I was in hospital for a while on the boat. We got back to Sydney, and we got back to Perth, actually. We spent a day in Perth, and then the Strathaiden on a very slow voyage back to Melbourne.
Yes.
Apparently the wharfies were on strike at that time, so that is why it took so long to... for the ship to cross the bight.
Yes.
There was no point in getting there early because they couldn't do anything with us.
So you were back in Australia?
Back in Australia.
What was the first thing you did when you got home? What did you want to do?
We landed at Perth, of course, and we... naturally went to the pub.
Yeah.
That seemed to be the big thing at the time. And then when same thing happened at in Melbourne, we weren't sure when we were going to catch a train back to Adelaide, but we're only there the one day, and we caught the train back to Adelaide.
But in the meantime, of course, you found out you'd been made up, you'd got your commission. And you'd risen to the rank of flying officer.
Yes, that's right.
That's
and all that money in the bank.
Quite an achievement. What did you do with all that money, Angus?
Hmm?
What did you do with all that money?
I just kept it,
yeah.
And we used it when we eventually built the house.
So, you've come back to peacetime Australia.
We come back to Australia. Things were fairly tough. There was no petrol. Well, my father had a car that was up on blocks for five or six years. And the only other thing, other transport was a bike.
Yes.
So we used to go on the bike. Everything was hard to get. And he took me into town one day, and I bought a refrigerator. And that was the first thing I ever that I bought in Australia after the war was a refrigerator. They didn't have one at home. Not many people did at the time, but because on first Christmas Day at home, we had no way of cooling the drinks. They were in a bucket under an orange tree with a wet towel over them. And they had a drip safe back in those days, a drip safe, and then an ice box, an ice chest.
So what did you do for employment? You come 1946, you had to look for a job, I guess. What did you do?
Oh, after that I went straight back to ICI, where I originally was.
Yes. And you stayed there?
I stayed there for a few years, and then I branched out on my own.
Mm-hmm.
Before I got enlisted, I was about a third way through my accountancy qualification. So in the meantime, once I got back home, that's what I picked up on.
Right. And these days, of course, society is very well aware of the psychological damage of traumatic war experiences. Did you have any problems like that? Did you have bad dreams? Were you haunted by the searchlights, haunted by memories of the march or imprisonment? Tell me about your inner peace or lack of inner peace.
The biggest thing was thunder.
Yes.
I was all, every time there was the thunder would come, I'd jump.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the worst experience. But even now at times you go through your dream certain things which happened, and it's like bringing back old memories.
Mm. You have an extraordinary story to tell, and you have some remarkable documents here. Your diary, your photographs, there's a drawing by an artist, a fellow prisoner of war, of the route taken on the march. What do you hope that society, that people learn from those experiences of yours?
Oh, I don't know. It's virtually we've had so many years without war, I don't know how the young people would be if it happened to them today. It's hard to tell, because most of us were brought up during the Depression, and that kind of I think helped a lot to us, whereas today it's been you've always tried to help your kids more so than we were helped.
Certainly. Well, you've certainly got some remarkable documents. I hope these are treasured and kept and read by others, because they do really tell an extraordinary story. Thank you for telling us your own words that story today, Angus Hughes.